So tonight, I thought I would talk about gratitude, since we're 2 weeks or 2 days away from Thanksgiving. And it's such an interesting holiday because our commercial economy doesn't have much to do with it. It's kind of this lack of statement. My daughter was remarking at all the Christmas decorations. She said, "What about Thanksgiving? You know, there's no, you know, big turkeys or pilgrims you can buy for your lawn." So it's a very different kind of a holiday that we often, people appreciate it, the lack of the commerciality. You don't have to buy gifts. You don't have to have this outflowing of money. So gratitude is an interest. We have an interesting relationship in the society because we do value it. We do value people saying thank you. We teach our children to say thank you, to write thank you notes. So this expression, this exchange of gratitude that we really value in a society. And it feels wonderful to be thanked, and it feels wonderful to thank, to thank for what has been given to you. So often we take this external form of gratitude that we use to kind of the polite way to be in society. It helps society feel comfortable. But tonight I'd like to talk more about the internal quality of gratitude, because sometimes we feel that external form is hollow. And our heart doesn't really connect with it. There's not this deep resonance of this spontaneous gratitude that just emerges. Because our relationship with gratitude isn't always wonderful, is it? I mean, have you ever been around a kitchen table before dinner and let's all say what we're thankful for, and your mind just goes blank? There's nothing that just, your heart feels cold and constricted, you're in pain, and there's nothing that you feel grateful for in that moment. So sometimes this quality of gratefulness, of gratitude, is hard to access in our life. We find ourselves following the external form without the internal supporting, without feeling that internal core of gratitude. And in our society, one of the worst things you can say about someone is that they're ungrateful. You know, that I gave them this and they're ungrateful. It's like a big taboo not to express that gratitude. We don't want to be called selfish or spoiled by not showing that we're grateful. But this creates a sense of pressure of how our behavior should look that tends to have effect of disconnecting us from our true experience. We follow the actual form of gratitude without connecting with the deep, perhaps the lack of gratitude that we feel. This separation from our experience really ensures that we will suffer. And this practice is about bringing our whole experience back into our heart so it's all seen and all acknowledged. So tonight I like to look at gratitude as if it's the expression of the awakened heart. It's something that is a natural expression of the awakened heart, coming from a sense of interconnection that we naturally see the world with gratitude. Not just when we are given something, but just the simple gratitude of being able to take another breath, to be able to stand, to be able to feel the wind. So bring it on par with the Brahma Viharas, the divine abodes of compassion, loving kindness, sympathetic joy, and equanimity. And it's not the words or ideas of gratitude, but really this wordlessness, this deep stillness of gratitude that is a spontaneous expression. So then when the absence of that spontaneous expression of gratitude, we find that in our experience, then we use the tools of mindfulness and investigation to see, well, what is going on here? How is it that I'm separate from life? How is it that my heart is closed down? How is it that I'm identified with my experience in a contracted way? Instead of being a source of guilt and shame, as we often use the lack of gratitude. So I'd like to just take a slight detour and talk about how can we skillfully use mindfulness and investigation in a positive way, in a way that's very helpful. Because sometimes we hear the word investigation and we think about thinking, you know, using our intellect to try to understand things. And mindfulness, we often take the sense of just being connected to our breath, just watching our breath, letting go of every other object. So last week I was in California for the Dedicated Dharma Practitioner Program, and there was a wonderful nun who was presenting. Her name was Aya Tayaloka, And she did this beautiful visual representation of the eightfold path. So you can imagine a circle with eight spokes representing the eight folds of the Noble Path. And around the center of that wheel is the axis is wise view. So that's what everything revolves around. Everything's connected to that. So if we're going to use investigation and mindfulness in a helpful way, we need to have a very clear understanding of what wise view is for us. So wise view can be defined different ways, but today I like to define it as taking nothing as I, me, or mine. Clinging to nothing as I, me, or mine. And that's, in a lot of ways, the very core of wise view. Because often we look out into the world and identify, this is mine, this is my wife, my child, my body, my emotion, my mind, my spiritual path, my gratitude. And all those are things we've laid over experience. And if we have the sense of what is really wise view, what's this quality of seeing without separation, without the sense of identity, that establishes true north for us, for our spiritual practice. And it's something that we look at all, everything that we do, how does it relate to this sense of non-self, of non-clinging? And so investigation, the quality of investigation, helps us check that compass bearing. Am I really going that directly to north? So she went on to explain that the axis has the hub around it, and the wheel has the hub. And that hub is wise mindfulness. So unless we're aware or connected to our experience, it's hopeless. You know, there's so much unconsciousness that really drives us and moves us through life. So wise mindfulness has the quality of making contact with the experience, but also has a kindness to it, has a quality of allowance. So it's not about being really focused on the breath to the exclusion of everything else. That's simply a concentration practice that we develop to help develop a sense of firmness of mind. But it's the ability to see all the display of mind-body, from our emotions, our thoughts, our body, and where, in particular, we start to identify with that, where we take this as being mine, as being I. And then finally, the rim of this wheel of the Dharma, the Eightfold Path, is wise effort. It's how do we bring the energy to our practices, to our lives in a very helpful way. Classically, the Buddha talked about four wise efforts. The effort of releasing that which is not helpful, of helping prevent the arising of that which is not helpful, and then encouraging the arising which is helpful, and then maintaining what is helpful, maintaining that arisenness. So in terms of our day-to-day practice, when we start to feel this sense of lack of gratitude, we bring these qualities of wise view, wise mindfulness, and wise effort to be able to really look at ourselves. The investigation helps direct where we cling, where we get tight around it. So it's important not to become tighter on the fact that you don't feel gratitude, don't feel a spontaneous gratitude, but instead look to see how it's a signal of being separate from life. So it calls forth our investigation. So let's explore some of the common patterns around gratitude. So gratitude sometimes is given in a conditional way. Okay, so it's an exchange. So if I get this much, I'll give this much gratitude. You know, if I get this present, I'll give you a thank you card. If I get this much of a gift, I'll give you a thank you card and a call. You know, there's this way we kind of weigh how much should I do, how little can I get away with. Sometimes this is the attitude. And as you notice, if you tune in, you can feel yourself following the polite societal constraints. But notice how there's a tightness of the heart. Where's this sense of unbounded gratitude, this unbounded relationship to others? You know, gratitude in its own sake. On a retreat, often you see people, before they eat, they were just center themselves and bow. In Japan, they say takemasu, which is basically you're acknowledging all the effort that went into that meal, all of the farmers, all the transportation, all the cooks, the servers, all the people that are supporting you in having this food. So it's a delightful way to help connect with this sense of gratitude. Sometimes we also want to get credit for being grateful. I remember when we got married, you know, Rodney married my wife and I some 11 years ago. And so I helped with the thank you cards, and I gave a thank you card to my guitar teacher. And he opened it up and said, well, you should thank, I wrote it myself, and he said, you should thank Ann for such a lovely thank you card. And I could just feel the tightness. It's like, I wanted credit. I wrote that card. You know, it was me who did it. So you can see how the identification came up with that, the sense of clinging. You know, what about having a sense of anonymous gratitude? Can we be gratitude without anyone knowing? In this last retreat, in Spirit Rock, there's a hut, a gratitude hut, that shows all the teachers and all their teachers. Right? There's a picture of Rodney as a monk with his teacher Buddhadasa behind him. And just felt this, you know, I just paused there with no one watching, with, you know, in the early morning, and just the gratitude for this caring of this precious message of the Dharma, this chance for being free of suffering. From the Buddha, through his students, through Rodney's teacher, and through Rodney. And just that spontaneous gratitude. So another thing that happens with gratitude is often the person we're trying to feel grateful toward is not a completely clean relationship. I mean, no relationship is completely beneficial. Every relationship causes pain or causes harm. So sometimes that pain becomes predominant, and it's hard to access the gratitude until that pain is acknowledged and felt. Because the hurt can become more predominant in our experience. So then we bring investigation, we bring mindfulness to that hurt, to that pain. So it often starts by first seeing the full story, seeing all the content and the storyline, but holding it in wise view. So holding the identities, holding the identification lightly. This is about feeling kind of the shadow side of the emotion, the shadow side of the beliefs. Just like within grief, you know, when you lose a loved one, there's often so much sadness and so much despair. But until we acknowledge the anger for that person leaving, the parts of the relationship that weren't so beautiful, then grief can't fully resolve. The same too with gratitude. We have to feel this fullness of the experience. I remember Rodney talking about just laying the whole contents of the mind out in front of you, and having this sense of non-judgment, just a complete acceptance of everything that it's seen in front of you. And when we're able to see that, then we can start to investigate where we identify with those parts. Well, if we start by trying to look at the investigation without acknowledging the whole spectrum, then we really shades how we see things. Because ultimately, it's about seeing where I am identified, where I cling, where I identify with those parts of my mind. We have to train ourselves to use mindfulness in a very, very gentle way. So the next thing that can help, that kind of prevents gratitude from being very spontaneous and being free-flowing, it's something that Christina Feldman talked about a couple weeks ago, that this tendency to focus, to really see what's broken, and this tendency of mind to look at what's not working in life, in our own minds, in our situations. There's kind of an imbalance of the mindfulness. There's a weighting of what's wrong. So it certainly has a survival component in our history, that we are able to see what needed to be done to help us survive. But we carry that into our own internal relationship. I was reading One Dharma from Joseph Goldstein, and he described one of his teachers. He was having a difficult time in his meditation on a retreat, and the teacher said, "Could you go to your room and reflect on your ethical behavior?" Okay. And so Joseph goes back, and he's just like, "Oh God, I said that wrong, and I was unkind in this action." And he just instead of lightening his load as the teacher intended, you know, like, you're an ethical person. Focus on what you've done well in your life to help bring some spaciousness. The tendency of mind was to contract around it, to focus on what's not working, what's broken. And this really becomes a subtle form of self-view, this deep sense of us being not adequate, not being right, this position of inadequacy. So bringing a sense of joy, a sense of lightness to our meditation, to our mind, to kind of to help balance that can be very important. This is something that Christina brought out that I very much appreciated. She talked about in Sri Lanka, in walking meditation, people walk around with smiles on their face. You know, they actually seem to be enjoying it. You know? You know, we look at our walking meditation, and if a little bit of makeup, we could pass for zombies. You know, just you know, if we have it, we had a day long on Halloween. I thought that would be great. You know, wouldn't take much more to be quite scary. And I was reading some king was commenting to the Buddha about his followers, that he could always tell which were the Buddha's followers because they were so radiant and so joyful. So remember, this is about being free of suffering. It's about having peace. So it's a different kind of happiness than we're trained for in the society, the happiness of possessions, of experience. It's a much deeper internally generated happiness and joy. And so creating space for this, creating a sense of notice the tendency of mind to focus on what's wrong, what's broken, with exclusion of everything else. Because there is often a lot good in our lives. And so it's often we think of that as being Pollyanna-ish. So I actually read the book Pollyanna to my daughter. And so this young girl, who's an orphan, you know, comes to this town, and everyone's self-obsessed with all of their ailments and their psychic, you know, their internal problems, their depression, their physical problems, they're lonely. And she goes around saying, well, look what's good in your life. Look what's working in your life. And so she transforms this whole town. You know, so much we focus on the 10% of our lives which isn't working, the 10% of our spiritual path that's not working, the 10% of the times that we've used wrong speech, that we've said something harshly. So it's important to acknowledge that because it can drive us unconsciously if it's not seen. But we don't want to ignore the other 90% that's working well. So, you know, to take time, especially when your mind's feeling very contracted, to acknowledge what's working in the life. Notice the times of non-clinging, the times of interconnection that's very easy, that's very beautiful. Notice the beauty as well as the pain. And this really makes it harder and harder to stay in this sense of self-inadequacy, the view of inadequacy that most of us carry around. So remember that as we go to the next part, which is an inner lack, an inner insufficiency. So bring a sense of lightness to this as we investigate that, a spaciousness around this investigation. So often when we have this deep sense of inadequacy, of something not being right in our lives, we take gratitude and it just kind of bounces off that. It just doesn't make any sense. It denies it or negates it. Because gratitude, really true gratitude, challenges that deep core sense of lack. So we tend to believe the lack more than the gratitude. So we can find that no matter how much we receive, and you know, how much people shower gifts and affection on us, we just push that away. We say, I'm not deserving of that. So there's certainly a whole layer of personal belief, psychological belief that we have to see and hold and see through. Well, if we keep going deeper and deeper, there's this core sense of hunger, this core sense of insufficiency in the moment. It's very, very subtle. If we become very, very still in the moment, we can start to see this yearning, this wanting. And the Buddha described it as only three directions it goes. Towards sense pleasures, wanting sense pleasures, sight, hearing, smell, taste, touch, thought. Remember, thought is considered a sense gate. To desire to be and the desire not to be. So sometimes you can notice when you're finding yourself in a you wanting to say something, you're excited about something, become very still and notice that, just that wanting to form, that hunger to be. Or if you're finding yourself in a lot of discomfort, difficult situation, notice the tendency to want to not be, to want to escape from life. And this can be a very subtle thing, but if we can be spacious with it and just connect with that hunger, it creates this whole freedom around the very deep thing that drives us. Because usually we're so much caught in the content. I'm trying to orchestrate my life to get things lined up so I'm finally happy. Get rid of this and get more of this. So to help access this, sometimes you can ask the question, what is lacking in this moment? What is truly lacking? It's like, oh, it could be a little warmer, it could be a little bit fuller, less, more comfortable. But what's really lacking in this very moment's experience? It's the same question as, where is there gratitude in this moment? So receiving gratitude is the final one I like to talk about. And this is something that many of you will experience a little bit later. So how does, when someone's expressing gratitude toward you, how does it land? Where does it sit and where does it hit with you? Is there a sense of letting it in? Really accepting this connection, this expression of someone reaching out the heart to acknowledge your efforts, to acknowledge your being? Or is there a sense of pushing it away and trying to avoid that? For many of us, when someone expresses gratitude, it triggers this deep sense of inadequacy, the sense of dislike and, you know, not being good enough. And no matter how much it's deserved, how much the gratitude's deserved, there's a way, it's almost like oil hitting a hot, water hitting a frying pan. It just spitters off. So as you feel that, if you start to feel that, bring forth mindfulness and investigation. Investigation is like becoming tuned to where those places of rub are, that sense of denial of your worthiness of being appreciated. Because all it's asking for is you to just to touch it, just to make contact with it, just to hold its hand, this deep sense of pain. That's all that's needed. Because then we can start to see where we claim it, where we claim our identity with it. But as long as we're pushing it away, we can't make that subtle contact. Then expressing gratitude is the same as receiving it. It comes from the same place. In its heart is just a wordless appreciation for life. So let's just sit quietly for a few moments. Thank you. So we have a few minutes for questions, if anyone would like to ask something. Yes. Okay, the three forms are craving. So craving for sense pleasures, craving for being, and craving for not being. Yes?
You said something about not turning investigation into an intellectual exercise.
Yes. So the question is about how to use investigation not as an intellectual exercise, but as its real fruitful way of working with it. So often in investigation, it's tricky because the mind likes to identify, likes to say, make an opinion, weigh in on what we see. So you're using a little bit of that quality to kind of direct, OK, Okay, this is where I'm clinging. This is where I am identified. This is where I'm contracted. So there's a slight bit of that quality. But it's almost like we're making a cake. We want to have maybe one-fifth with this quality of the mind, of the intellect or thought, and then four-fifths connected with the body, with the direct experience. So it's part, it really comes back to this sense of right view. Because we can easily start to identify with what we're seeing. So there's this sense of looking and asking a question. It's often asking a question and then waiting for the answer. While using the intellect too much, it's like we ask the question and we say, well, I think it has to do with the seven factors of enlightenment and the Eightfold Path being misunderstood. I mean, we start to have more and more elaboration. So as we become more ungrounded in our bodies with through meditation, we can start to sense when we start to veer off in that direction. Does that make sense? Basically, you always want to err on the side of simplicity. You know, always be more simple. It's using the investigation to help direct the mind, direct inquiry, the attention really, so you can see, you can experience very deeply. It's a direct experience is what we're looking for. So sometimes we don't have that sense of what's a direct experience may not be so clear. Often, you know, as I teach a beginning class, that's one of the first things people have to understand is feeling the breath and thinking about the breath are not the same thing. There's a big difference between experiencing it and actually conceptualizing it. Yes?
I think a lot of us are sort of in helping professions or want to help people. And one of the things I've noticed is that I feel sort of compelled to go up an extra for people to try to help them. And the other 2 weeks ago, I did something and I thought, I messed it up, so I have to do this other thing for them. And I did it. And then later, I felt like, wow, that was really nice of me. And in a way, I thought, that if I just keep thinking that I don't have to do it, I'm not compelled to do it, I just think, oh, that was really sweet of me, maybe I won't do it the next time. I don't know if that makes sense, but it was a different kind of a feeling. And I think some of the reason why we want to kind of do things that people are going to be grateful for we don't feel the warmth from what we do. We just feel like we want to do more.
So the question is, particularly in a helping profession, that sometimes what motivates our caregiving is to feel like we're giving. Is that kind of it, Moffat?
Yeah, without feeling good about it, just feeling like, okay, what else could I do? Or I didn't do enough, or it wasn't perfect, or there's three other people who needed that, and I didn't do it for them. So it seemed interesting that it didn't really feel as good as it.
So the giving, choosing to give to one person and not another person, just noticing it doesn't feel as good as it should. Yeah, so it's really important to notice what motivates our expression of giving, or in this case, generosity. Is it coming from a sense of lack? Is it coming from a sense of trying to get some other secondary payoff? And it's hard in the helping profession because that's part of your job description. As you help, well, how much do you help? How much do you go to the extra way? So the good news is that you have the perfect spiritual path for you, right? So your life's going to show you exactly where your edges are. So the important thing is that you notice that this didn't feel quite right. I had this expectation that if I did this, I would feel good about myself. Okay, and it didn't quite match up. So what's going on here? Not with a sense of like a hammer trying to tear things apart, but more trying to really bring out into relief what's kind of the deeper unconscious things which are driving this. And then that help with burnout. It help you feel like, okay, this is having boundaries. This is what I need to do for this person. This is what I'm called to do. And this is too much. You know, always hold yourself in the mix, holding yourself equally. Any other questions? Well, should we go ahead to the next part of the evening?